warm welcome to all our Campus FM listeners today. This series is entitled Back in Time. In all the episodes, we have been discussing broad themes associated with the study of archaeology and trying to understand why these various fields are really significant in the exploration of the past. Before I introduce today's guest, I should mention that this program is being recorded on Zoom, so if you hear a few noises off, you'll know why. So helping us in our explorations today is Dr. Katrine Fenech, who is a freelance environmental archaeologist. Dr. Fenech is going to talk about aspects of ancient archaeological environments. It's a huge subject, but I'm sure she will open a window for us on this fascinating field of study. So on with my first query for Dr. Fenech. I think it's always best, and my listeners almost expect now, me to ask for a definition. How would you describe environmental archaeology? And do you have a particular expertise within the field?
Good morning, Tricia, and good morning to the listeners. Thank you very much for inviting me today to be part of the program. It's a very exciting program. Congratulations for having such a program on Campus FM. As you described, yes, I am an environmental archaeologist. Environmental archaeology basically makes a distinction from the normal archaeologist, because whilst the so-called normal archaeologist is in the field excavating, getting really happy when he finds a piece of pottery or some architectural remains or anything, skeletons, bones, what have you. This is, of course, very interesting, but not my field. I go completely crazy when I find snails or other stuff that helps me to reconstruct a past environment. Because whilst it's nice to have architectural remains, temples and tombs, whatever, and the people who were using it, it has to be seen within the context. Is it where in the landscape? Is it on top of a hill? Is it in the basin of a hill? Is it nestled somewhere else? What did they do with the surroundings? Was it, for example, we would say that in the UK, was there a forest around it? In Malta, it's a bit more difficult. Basically, the landscape gives the context, because it's an interaction that the people have with their surroundings. And I use basically the buckets of soils that are excavated. They pick out the pottery. I pick out the rest. Basically, I take the bucket. What's on the spoil heap? For them, it's useless. For me, it's gold. And that is basically what I then use to reconstruct past environments by completely sieving through stuff that gets literally otherwise thrown away. From the past environment and from those analysis that I make, I can deduct as well the human impact that those people had on the environment and the human activity. Obviously, it's the more samples I have, the clearer the picture gets. Whether it's laterally spread on the site or whether it's vertically spread in a time sense, whilst, from sites that go back to prehistory, for example, and that continue being used up to Bronze Age, Punic periods, Roman times. And from those vertical changes, so to speak, you can detect changes in the environment, in the human activity. Climatic changes can be detected on a broad scale. So even if a dramatic event happens, that can be found as well from that. And that is the exciting part. Yeah.
Well, in fact, my next question was going to be, how does one actually go about reconstructing this past environment? What are the methodologies that you have in your toolkit to be able to do that? Perhaps you go into a little bit more detail.
Well, environmental archaeologists, many of them are jacks of all trades. I don't want to say master of none, that would be mean. But they have a broad knowledge of several aspects of the environment. There are various ways of how to analyze a bucket or what to analyze from a bucket. There are soil studies that can be made, and different results can be obtained from looking just at the soil color of a particular site. Then you have people who make studies of the stone content, the granulometry, sand content that's part in it, what kind of stones. There's a difference if you have, for example, angular stones in a sediment or pebbles, because, you know, where you find it then also makes the difference. Pollen is very often done as well, pollen analysis. And molluscan analysis, that's what I specialize in, is rarer done, because that depends on the environment, because the shells only survive in alkaline environments or in waterlogged environments. So if I went, for example, to certain parts in Europe where we have acidic soils, I wouldn't find a snail. It doesn't survive. So Malta in that sense is perfect because of the alkaline soils. The mollusks do survive millennia. And that is great, because like this, we really could go back 10,000 years in history without any problem. They kept the snails. They got a bit frittle, you know, who wouldn't with that age? But yes, they do survive. Whilst pollen analysis is a bit more tricky in the Maltese Islands, it's because of the alkaline soils, bacteria eats it up. And there is a bias. Not everything survives. If the soils have been aerated, only the sturdiest ones survive, and you only get a small glimpse. So what's usually done is both are being combined. You have somebody who's a palynologist, which is the name of the pollen study people, and a malacologist, that's somebody who does snails, and they work together to complete a picture. In all fairness, we will never get a complete picture. There are always holes in this big puzzle of a picture of which we don't know what it's supposed to look like. There are always holes, but we can fill in the gaps together much, much better than just with one look.
In fact, I did a little bit of reading. It's not my area of archaeology, so I really plead ignorance. But I did look up a few papers on the subject in preparation. And it did seem to be a very collaborative kind of field, where there were people with quite diverse areas of expertise who would be doing their separate work, but then would be coming together collaboratively to complete as much as possible the picture. Would that be a good explanation of how it works?
That's the ideal picture, yes, and that is how it ideally works. And we've had an example where it worked very, very well like this. When I was part of the Phrixus project, where the aim of that project was to make investigations into Neolithic Malta, encompassing literally everything. So there were so many diverse experts in their fields together. I was privileged to be invited to work on that project as well. And I worked very well with the pollen person, Michelle Farrell, together, and we pieced together a lot of information to reconstruct those environments in the past. You know, that was very good. Yeah.
Yeah, I hope we'll go into a little bit more detail if we have time towards the end of the program. Whereabouts would these activities take place? I mean, we hear about doing cores in the Arctic or the Antarctic. Taking cores out of the ice. We talk about, you know, you've mentioned the idea of looking into different areas where these analyses can take place. I mean, what would be the best conditions to be able to actually do this kind of analysis? Well, talking globally, sort of, not just here.
I don't think it can be assessed with evaluation, good or bad, where you can take those kind of samples, because oftentimes from beforehand you don't know what you find. It's literally the proof of the pudding is in the eating. I could, for all I care, take a bucket of soil from my back garden and analyze that one and find some really, really interesting stuff that I never would have imagined before. Or I can go to an archaeological site and I think, oh, we really should find something really, really interesting over here, and then it proves not to be that interesting. Although even if it's not that interesting, even a boring answer is an answer, in the sense that, you know, it's difficult to evaluate that. Now, what you can do is you can make a distinction whether to take a sediment core is a good idea, or whether bulk samples with a bucket is a good idea. That depends on the site and on the research question, basically. So for excavations, usually it's buckets of soils, bulk samples that are taken, and then from those bulk samples you make the analysis and you get a broad picture, usually laterally and vertically, over a broad site. Now, if you take a core sample, you need obviously depth, and otherwise it's not worth it to get the really, really heavy and expensive equipment to drill down your core. So you need a depth of, well, it's hard to say what's good, but the best core we had 11 meters depth. So then obviously you can make, but obviously to have those sediments accumulate in the first place, you must be in a basin where sediments can be washed into. So you get sediments from an area, from a watershed that can be fairly small, let's say 10 square kilometers, or you get it from the Marsa Basin, for example, that's the largest watershed area we have. That's around, I think it was 50 square kilometers. It was huge, basically. So, but then it at the same time dilutes the picture. And with a core, it's a bit of hit and run. Either you hit it and you're lucky, but you can make a complete miss right next to it, you know? So it's a lot of it. I don't want to say it's haphazard because it doesn't sound very scientific, but oftentimes scientific discoveries are actually quite haphazard. You know, that's the nature of the things, paradoxically.
Absolutely. I'm fascinated by this idea of sort of the going down. So you're going to get you're interested in stratigraphy in that sense. But you're also interested in the lateral kind of.
Yes. Yeah.
I think that's fascinating, and also how these, like, if you're doing something in a valley and you know that things have been washed in, how do you actually account for the fact that things wash in from different layers? It seems so very complex to me.
It is enormously complex, and it's not just that things get washed in, depending on your site, things can also get washed out, you know? So you have stuff accumulating, and then for all you know, there is a big storm, like the one you had last week, the northeasterly wind that comes, and whoosh, an unknown proportion of what has just been washed down is being washed out and being removed. And I wish I could say you can see it in the core, but you can't. Not at first glance. The most complex core I ever analyzed was the one of Marsa, where we had 11 meters of sediments in this watershed basin. And so you have at the basin of it the soil that accumulates naturally because it's from the bedrock. And then you have sediments accumulating on top of it. They come, they get washed in. But they don't only get washed in from the watershed, they also get washed in if you have a big storm, you get sandy sediments thrown on top. And then you have this alternating story of sand from the sea with sediments from the land, always on top of each other. And then a huge wave comes and takes an unknown portion away. And another portion, then a big storm comes and throws everything back on top of it. And then you have inverted stratigraphies all the time. So although they are very, very exciting cores, because it's never really boring, they have a tendency, I got frustrated at one point, because you just look at it and say, like, this is one whole mess. How am I going to make heads and tails out of this? But But in the end, it still tells a story. Even a messy story is a story.
Absolutely.
Because things are never straightforward. And, you know, this is just another mirror of how it really is never really that straightforward, which is at least interesting.
That's certainly interesting. What about the sort of how does the reconstruction that you create, you and your colleagues create sort of together collaboratively within, how does it feed into the wider archaeological fields? Sort of, as all these themes that we've been talking about during these episodes, we're talking about pottery, we're talking about hydrology, we're talking about other things, even texts and things that help to support this fantastic discipline of archaeology. How would you say, how would you describe the kind of support that your field gives to archaeology in general? What do you offer to all the other people who are working in the other fields?
That's twofold. If it's an archaeological site, like let's take the Roman villa in Zeytun. There are the snails that occur naturally in an environment. And from those snails, I can make deductions about the environment and say, for example, it was predominantly open country, or it was over here was a patch of lots of leaf litter, because although the majority of the snails is very generous with the kind of environments they can live in, there are a few snail species that are very habitat specific, and they can only live or live best in their specific environment, and these are these so-called indicator species. There are species I would only find, for example, if I have a lot of leaf litter, or if it's extremely dry, or if it's stone, you know. And if I find these, it's very easy to get a general idea of what the picture was like. And then if I have assemblages of many, many different species together, they also work together and say, I can say, oh, this is a garrig. And from the garrig, I can say there was stone, and there was also a bit of soil with a bit of humidity in it. And there were also tall growing herbs on which other snails could sit. To see whether it's a natural assemblage is usually quite easy, because juveniles are present in the site. If, like, for example, I just find on a site hundreds or thousands of the same snail, like a midden, then okay, people brought these snails to the site, they collected them somewhere, and they ate them. They don't give any idea about the close environment, because they could have come from anywhere, you know. So that I can make a distinction. Okay, this has been brought here by human action, and this is here naturally. That's one distinction. Then from the human action, it can be deduced where they got them from. For example, in Tasilt, it was very good. There were lots of marine species. They obviously don't occur naturally on a land site. So they have been brought up. There are two options how they can find their way into an archaeological site. One is by people, and another one is by animals, because birds, for example, find their shell, fly somewhere where it's nice and quiet, and eat it on land. But that would just be the odd shell, basically. If it's a huge conglomeration of other shells and from mixed habitats, it's obvious that people brought them up to the site. And most of the shells that we had found at Tasilt were, in fact, edible. So they would have gotten them down from the bay. We could see from the coccus, for example, that they got that. Oh, yes, from the sandy bay they got them. They got them from the shore. And it was very interesting, because they didn't dive deep. They really just waded through, as if they couldn't swim. They waded through whatever they could reach with their hands on being on foot. So also everything that was close to the shore was collected, and that could be eaten. So that's an addition that I can give as well to an archaeologist on a site and say, ah, obviously, you look at it and say, it probably was food. I can say, yes, it actually was food, and they got it from here, there, and there. So not from far away.
So you got a sort of a picture, I'm imagining, this archaeological site, and you're giving it its environment, what was happening,
yes,
environmentally, physically,
yeah,
around it at the time, and placing, yes, it in that environmental context,
mm-hmm,
and also then helping to describe what the people who lived in that particular, mm-hmm, article site actually were doing at the time. So
yeah,
that really sort of widens the area enormously, and, mm-hmm, the knowledge about a site.
Yes, no, it is.
So that is sort of actually describing the landscape within a particular time frame. So it sounds very positive, but we mentioned before this possibility of might get a false picture of the situation. What are the caveats? What are the things that sort of might not actually be valid in a particular site? What are the dangers of these descriptions?
The question, the first thing that has to be established is, are the snails there naturally, or have they been brought there by other agents? Mainly people, but it could also be natural agents like rainwater and what have you. Once it's established that they're naturally, then obviously the next question, if they're there naturally, it's not the bucket from over here says this thing, the bucket from over there says a slightly different thing, because obviously you have a variability. It's impossible to sample the complete site. I mean, probably you can do it, but you want to have a life as well. So you take a spot over here and you take a spot over there. So basically it's a spot that we have and a spotty view that we have here, there, and there, which gives a variability in your best cases. I don't want to say best cases. In other cases, it's here the same, there the same, there the same, and there the same, which is interesting as well, although it does sound boring, but it says something as well, the homogeneity of a site or the heterogeneity of it. But it's never the complete picture, for that same reason that we cannot take everything. So
you have to take an educated and guess based, yes, on the knowledge that you've actually managed to get.
Yes, and it could also be that the most interesting snail that was actually part of the deposit was not in the bucket. You know, it could be right next to it. Yes. These things happen. Yes. So we can work with what there is. In fact, we can only work with what there is and not what there isn't or what there could be. So,
right. Mm. You read for your PhD at the University of Malta, I believe.
Yes.
And in fact, I do remember the day that you passed your viva, and you happened to also be giving a talk, to the Archaeological Society or,
yes,
something like that at the time, on the very day. And I was very, we were all very impressed that you still had the energy to talk to us. And I remember being very interested, because it's not an area that I know, you know, much about. I was wondering whether you could tell us a bit about how that thesis, how that project actually came about, and how it all sort of came together to create this very interesting thesis.
It was actually a very, very long story. I'm trying to cut it short.
We only have a few minutes, unfortunately.
Okay. When I was in my first year of archaeology, normal student, mature student, I was already 33 years old when I started studying. I had the opportunity to specialize in environmental archaeology. And Professor Frendo had given me that opportunity, and I grabbed it, and I thanked him very much for it. I had no idea what it meant, but I said yes. And then I learned pollen analysis in Huddersfield for 3-4 weeks, came back and took part at the university excavation in Tasilj, and worked the summer in the lab, but also did other research and was already thinking about how my thesis is going to be, because obviously that I cannot concentrate on something and then make my thesis on Roman tombs or something like this. You know, I had to do something with my new learned expertise. And I got a tutor, thankfully, from the Department of Biology, Professor Patrick Schembri, and he was extremely helpful. And when suddenly the vacancy arose in the mollusk department, the person who was doing them before had changed his course of studies, as he said, wouldn't you like to do mollusks, you know, snails? I said, snails? Okay. I said, no idea what I was again talking about. I said, yes, of course, no problem. And then he introduced me to all those different kind of snails, and it was actually extremely, extremely interesting. And because of the excavation of Tasilsch, I could then make my undergrad dissertation on some sediments from Tasilsch, where I analyzed those sediments with my newly found knowledge, where I tried to discuss the changes from the Bronze Age to the Punic period, environmental-wise. And those were some undisturbed deposits. And that was super, super interesting. I was really happy when I had done it. And then I had done my BA honors, and I was very happy about it. And Professor Schembri then looked at me and said, so, Katrin, what are we going to do now? And I said, I have no idea, you know. So he said, okay, let's look around and see what else we can do, you know. And we were looking for sediments here, there, and what have you. And it was difficult to find a suitable site, because we wanted to go into the Neolithic, a suitable site where I could work in peace without being too much interrupted by museums department and the regulations that there are in place. They're obviously there for a reason. So we were looking, and then Professor Niklas Weller once looked at me and said, listen, there is this site in Marsa. They're building something there at the moment. There are many deep sediments. You should go and have a look. And I said, oh, that sounds good. So I drove down. It was on my way home. I stopped in Marsa. I went to the sports ground. I saw the site. I said, this really looks great. And then I phoned up Professor Schembri. He said, I think we found the site. The problem now is the money. He said, yo, we need to take at least two cores. Yes. I said, he said, where do you get the money from? I said, And then I phoned up Linda Enix, very, very nice person. She's American. And I phoned her up and said, listen, just in case, are you in Malta? She said, yes, I'm at the Hypogeum at the moment. I said, I'm in Marsa. Please come down. We found a golden site. I need your help. She came down. She looked at the site. She said, how much you want? I said, well, I need X amount of money to get the course. She said, here's X amount of money. Get them. And like this, we had the site, the money, everything fell together like a puzzle. It was amazing. You know, it's like one of those moments where you say, you're in the right moment, at the right time, with the right people. And it was brilliant. So then we took those cores. The core then was split in two. The other half went up to the UK. There was Frank Carroll in those days, and he was working on the pollen, and he was doing his PhD on the pollen from that core as well. He was there supervised by Chris Hunt, who had also taught me how to do pollen analysis. And so then we had this collaboration suddenly going with pollen and mollusks again together. He did his work, I did my work, and yes, we both did our PhDs from that, and as I said, this was the core from hell, with sediments that gave me sleep, many sleepless nights. We pieced it together then in the end, and I was very happy about my thesis, and I thought we had found a great story. And then afterwards, when the Phrexos project came about, we got more money for dates, and we could date more of the core, and we saw that the story was actually, in fact, much more complex than that, with more sediments being thrown in, taken off, and what have you. And, yeah, but it was super exciting.
That's a fantastic story to end with. Well, I unfortunately, we ran out of time.
Oh, wow, okay.
And I shall have to close this very interesting discussion, and I'd like to thank Dr. Katrin Fenech for being with us today. This is the last episode in this series, but I hope that Back in Time will be back on air in the near future with new discussions about the wonderful field of archaeology. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.